to What You Missed This Week. I'm Joe Weisenthal. This podcast has some of our favorite interviews from the Daily Market Close Show that I co-anchor along with Romain Bostic and Caroline Hyde. What You Miss? It's the perfect way to kick off your weekend. We kicked off this week talking about President Biden's massive $2.25 trillion infrastructure plan. Everyone loves the idea of infrastructure, but now that the White House plan is actually here, it's facing some pushback from Republicans as well as moderate Democrats, with some fighting over the meaning of the word infrastructure. However you define it, though, it will be expensive. Alan Levy, a fellow at NYU's Marin Institute, joined us to talk about why these projects carry a higher price tag in the United States versus other countries.
So the number one reason is a problem, I would say, a problem of curiosity above all. Countries tend to learn mostly from themselves, and then sometimes they think we need to learn from other people. So you will see, usually it's poorer countries learning from richer countries, smaller countries learning from larger countries. And the United States, while it's a very rich country, it's a very big country, it's a very culturally dominant country. Everyone in the global elite speaks English. Not everyone speaks German, Japanese, Chinese, Spanish, French. So it's very easy to think that because America is good at so many things, in biotech, in tech, in agriculture, in mining, it's also the best at literally everything, such as infrastructure construction, which it is not. So it is. So even if there may have been a completely random reason that happened 70 years ago that led American costs to be higher than European costs, and it just doesn't get corrected because people in the United States are not as familiar with how things work in other countries, especially ones that don't speak English.
So I'm curious, Alan, though, I mean, how do you sort of change the structure here in the U.S.? Because, every country sort of falls back onto what they know best, and we do whatever we do here in the U.S., and whether that's best or not, certainly debatable. But how would you change the mindset here to even get us to a level where we could sort of compete at a cost level with other countries?
So you need certain legal reforms, some kind of more understanding of engineering techniques. But the basic idea is to understand that the frontier of transportation infrastructure construction of the most innovative technology is not, unfortunately, in North America. The main frontier parts of the world in this are continental Europe and East Asia, and it's mostly rich East Asia. China does some nice things, but China is not at the global frontier. The construction costs in China are actually rather average. And so, for example, you might want to look at the exact set of techniques, and I can give some examples. I could give a lot more examples if I had 10 hours of things that are being done. For example, for the high-speed rail plan, and people are talking about giving $80 billion to Amtrak. So you could, for example, look at what Germany is doing right now to improve its intercity rail. And of course, Germany is also big and rich and maybe doesn't learn from everyone that you'll be learning to. So you can learn from the countries Germany is trying to learn from, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Austria, and see how they minimize costs whenever they can. They try to avoid overbuilding. They try to do things that aren't just being cheap. They're inexpensive, but also really high quality. That they try to make sure that the trains always connect, to figure out how to make sure the trains run exactly on time. In Switzerland, if you have a rail ticket, it's likely to involve a connection, and the connection might take 5 minutes, and you will make it because they made sure the trains are going to run in time, so they can do that. So it's useful to learn how they do that, and to learn certain construction techniques that are being used in Japan and South Korea.
To do that, Elon, do you send people to those countries? Do you get them to come here? Do you just sort of make a cultural exchange, an exchange of information? What's the best practical way of making that happen?
So what you're proposing, the two exchanges, it's funny. We literally had a meeting at the research group trying to think about this. And we talked about both of these. So the answer is yes, but it's important that you have longer exchanges. You don't just send the managers for a four-day docket trip in which, oh, everyone wants to go on a four-day docket trip that looks like a fact-finding trip where you're just vacationing in Barcelona, in Rome, in Berlin. Everyone likes these, but you don't learn very much. Instead, what you want is to maybe send someone on exchange for a period, for a longer period, maybe measured in months. And I know there are exchange programs between various European railways already. I know someone who works for the German railway, Deutsche Bahn, who was doing this for a couple weeks in Russia. And I know they also do this with Japan, so it's not just internally to Western Europe. So participating in this program, hiring people, hiring some of the managers from agencies in Spain and in Italy and in Sweden and so on, and having them help run infrastructure construction in America would be really useful.
So we just have like about a minute left. Let's say President Biden calls you up and says, Alon, I'd really like you to advise me on this $2.25 trillion infrastructure plan. Obviously, Biden himself or you yourself can't unilaterally change the culture. What would be the most important thing for that should be written into the bill such that we have at least a shot of getting stuff built in a reasonably timely manner?
So for writing stuff into the bill, I would look at certain practices that are used for cost control, such as fighting lawsuits. If you have NIMBY lawsuits, you probably want to fight them rather than surrender to them. You probably want to avoid overbuilding. You want to avoid the problem where you have this other people's money problem, where state or a locality just uses federal money to do unrelated things, and try to require some measure of cost control in the bill in order to prioritize infrastructure.
Visa recently made waves when it announced that transactions on its payment service could be made using the stablecoin USD Coin, a stablecoin powered by the Ethereum blockchain. So, the cynic that I am, I was not convinced, and at the time I even tweeted, quote, I strongly believe this will go nowhere and I'd like to make a bet on this with someone. So we spoke with someone who could make me eat my words, Diogo Monica, the co-founder and president of Anchorage, a digital asset platform for institutions, which is involved with the Visa news, and he joined us to tell me why I was wrong.
So I'm definitely going to take the other side of that bet, and the way that I'll do it is by maybe zooming out a little bit and saying, number one, not all crypto is Bitcoin. And you're absolutely right that Bitcoin has been invested as capital preservation, store of value. And since the value fluctuates, people are hesitant to sell their Bitcoin for fiat. However, just in the past 24 hours, there has been over $160 billion of stablecoins transacted. And so there is a type of crypto called stablecoin that tracks the value of other fiat currencies like the US dollar that is perfect to be transacted. So if we go back to Anchorage's partnership with Visa and what Visa announced this last week, what we're seeing is a dramatic difference and change in the market structure. There are companies that are crypto companies that want to offer banking services without ever having to rely on the fiat rails. And now with this Visa partnership, they can. They can actually replace the settlement side from the crypto company that is issuing a Visa credential all the way to Visa without ever having to touch fiat. And so that is what's actually being announced. It is a change in the market structure and is not something that is reliant on Bitcoin. It was really something that has to do with stablecoins and the power of stablecoins to change the market structure of, in this case, the payment system in the United States.
So instead of using a US dollar ever along that rail, as you say, use USDC instead, this so-called stablecoin aligned with the value of the US dollar. Why pick USDC? Are there going to be plenty of other stable coins? Will they end up becoming part of the Visa rails and payment network?
That's right. USDC is actually not the largest stable coin in the crypto market. It actually represents a small percentage of it. There is many other stable coins. And we also saw the announcement of the Diem project, in which Anchorage is also part of, that is also the goal is to have something that is stable, that is easy to use. If we take a step back further and we say, what is the current status quo of someone that wishes to have a FISA credential? It is pretty hard for people to do. There's hundreds of companies issuing these Visa credit cards or Visa debit cards that actually have backing of normal dollars. What is happening is that companies like Crypto.com have a lot of interest from their client base to actually have crypto back the actual Visa card purchases. So you can buy a coffee using crypto. You're just not doing it with Bitcoin. You are tapping your Visa card, and on the back end, all of it is being taken care of by Anchorage. And what is in it for Crypto.com? Why do they care about this? Well, because before, they needed a relationship with an issuing bank. They actually needed fiat dollars deposited on a bank account just sitting there so they could settle with Visa 24 hours later to actually settle the whole transactions. Now, they don't need that. They can settle in a matter of minutes. The transaction is irrecoverable in the sense that there is no clawback. It is more efficient. It has strong finality and is going directly to Visa and USDC by using the Anchorage crypto platform. So that is what we're offering to the companies.
And I could definitely see how those folks who are sort of have bought into the crypto and the sort of blockchain world would definitely see the advantage of it. But how do you sort of approach, you know, I guess regular people who are still, you know, tethered to fiat currencies, which is probably like, you know, 99% of the world? I mean, what's the value proposition for them to say, let me do this using my Visa-linked card as opposed to just using my Visa-linked card, which is linked to actual dollars?
So that is the beauty of this, is that the retail clients, you and I, continue operating the same way. But now we have superpower. We can actually connect our Visa card to our account, our crypto account at crypto.com, for example, in this case, which was the first company that is actually participating in this pilot with Visa and Anchorage. And for them, there is no different. They are spending their money and they don't actually care at the end of the day. At the end of the day, if you have an app on your phone and on one side it says USD and on the other side it says USDC, for you as a consumer, they are both dollars. Yeah. And if you start being able to spend it equally, then that is the answer of mass adoption of crypto by consumers. Yeah. It is the exact same thing that you did yesterday, just on crypto rails.
Mm. Got it.
Diogo, is Visa betting on mass adoption of crypto by everyone, or is Visa more wanting to ensure that it serves everyone, even the unbanked, even those particularly in emerging markets?
I think they're definitely betting on mass adoption of crypto. And the interesting thing here is that this particular partnership doesn't even rely on mass adoption. There's another way for you to look at this and actually think about this partnership, and it is efficiency. We are working in a fiat world that is, in many cases, T+2. We've seen a lot of issues with T+2 in the past few months in the structure of the market. If you can eliminate those structures, if you can have less trust between parties, if you can have more finality on the settlements and faster settlements, why not take that? Regardless for now, for the moment, of the consumer adoption, if you have a way of using crypto to make the current market structure better, why not do it? And that is part of the partnership that is happening now, is us using crypto to, for this specific segment, making the market infrastructure better.
Now, marijuana has been gaining momentum on both sides of the Atlantic. Recently, New York and Virginia both legalized recreational use, with Virginia becoming the first southern state in the country to do so. While over in the UK, London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who is up for re-election, is promising to set up a commission to examine the benefits of decriminalization if he wins another term. So we spoke about these developments in the space with Boris Jordan, the executive chairman of Curaleaf, which just closed a deal to buy MAC Life Sciences for about $285 million, giving the company an entry into Europe's rapidly growing cannabis market. We started by asking Boris if things were more exciting for the marijuana industry in the US or in Europe.
I mean, obviously the United States is where the near-term growth is gonna be. The market's much more developed than Europe. We have a tremendous amount of states, as you just mentioned, moving from medical to recreational. It's not only New York, it's Minnesota, it's New Mexico, I believe Vermont and Connecticut has indicated they want to do it this July. I think Pennsylvania is going to be next. So it's a domino. We said this, you know, when New Jersey voted in November, I said to everybody, I think this is a domino effect from here on. And that's what's happened. And it's happened, to be honest, faster than we thought. So definitely the major growth is in the United States, and Curaleaf's major focus continues to be the U.S. But Europe is not far behind. Europe is where we were in 2017. And, you know, Curaleaf from 2017 till now grew from, you know, $17 million of revenues to over $1 billion of revenues. So
yeah.
I think that's where Europe is today. And Curaleaf decided to put its footprint to move our brands into Europe. And we bought the largest operator in Europe. And we also raised $130 million of financing in order to finance that build out. So we're very excited about the European operation. And the big differentiation between Europe and the U.S. is that Europe is a capital light model. Europe is, it's legal. The medical business in Europe is absolutely, you know, legal in the EU. And so we don't have to build these operations in every single country. We can build a centralized operation in Portugal and Spain, which is where we are, and then distribute it through all of Europe.
Well, and so once you get that sort of distribution level, I mean, you're not worried at all about any sort of impediments with regards to any of the member states maybe deciding that they want to sort of set their own parameters. You're certain here that we're going to have sort of that, I guess, blanket rule coming out of the EU.
So under the it's very interesting, under the UN charter, medical is legal. And so Europe has taken the position that it you can cross borders with it. So there is no impediments today on medical in Europe. Today, EMAC sells to the UK, to Germany, to Italy, to Spain, to France, and now to Israel. So there is no impediments in Europe. Now, adult use, and you've heard recently, Switzerland and Holland have announced adult use pilot programs. And the reason they call them pilots is because under the UN charter, recreational and adult use cannabis is not yet legal. But if you call it a pilot, you can launch it. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the regulatory environment develops in Europe around adult use cannabis as it moves forward here.
So going back to the U.S. for a second, we started with that map showing the, you know, the patchwork of state regulation. Some state there's nothing, some is medical, some recreational. How costly is that to have, you know, you mentioned that the advantage in Europe is because it's medical is legal, you can consolidate production, capital light. How costly is it for, you know, sort of U.S.-based businesses to have such a wide range of legal regimes?
So Curaleaf last year spent about $125 million on capital expenditures. This year, we'll probably spend, now that New York has legalized, we'll probably spend closer to $180 million in CapEx. So that's about what we're putting to work every single year. Curaleaf, since its founding, has probably spent close to $1 billion in building its infrastructure in the United States, which is why we have the leadership position that we do. We're in 23 states. We're now doing national launches of products. As we forecasted, we'll do somewhere between $1.2 and $1.3 billion in revenue this year. That's on the back of a $650 million a year last year. So about 100% growth year on year.
Boris, there's $130 million from a single strategic institutional investor. Now, I'm interested that they're not divulging who they are, but we get very excited when we look at other sort of really ballooning areas such as crypto, when institutional players come in, we like say, this is a sign of real support. What does this investment mean to you? Why are they doing it, and why not saying who they are?
Well, this particular investor is very excited about the European market. They see that Europe is exactly as I said, where the United States was 4 or 5 years ago. Europe is a market that's 1.5 times bigger. The economy is 1.5 times bigger than the U.S. The cannabis use is just as prolific as the United States. And so there's a huge opportunity. If you think about Curaleaf in 2017, Curaleaf was a $300 million market cap company. Today, it's a $10.7 billion market cap company. So in 4 years, you know, we grew quite dramatically. And if you think that that's the kind of growth prospects that you have in Europe, I suspect that investors believe that that's the kind of growth they're going to see. And that's why we financed it at the European level, because we also didn't want to breach the veil, right? I mean, Europe is legal, and we wanted to maintain that legal status. And so we raised money at the European level.
And we finished the week with some highly anticipated PPI data. Producer prices climbing more than forecast last month, rising by the fastest rate since 2011. We also got some more niche price data with wood pallets increasing. So with so much focus on inflation, we took a look at price stability and the difference between normal inflation and hyperinflation. And our guest was Zach Carter, who is the author of the best-selling book, The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. We started by asking him if wood pallet price increases typically precede hyperinflation.
Well, if it is, I haven't seen it in the data. I don't claim to have seen all economic data from all time, but that's not one I've watched super closely. I think there's an understanding of inflation, sort of demand-driven inflation, that if you have enough aggregate demand in the economy, people's purchasing powers will push prices higher. But that's different from hyperinflation. Hyperinflation is something that happens when you have a political crisis. And so inflation can be a problem. It could be something you want to worry about, something you want to fight. But it's a distinct problem from hyperinflation, which is when people lose faith in the legitimacy of a government, frankly.
And which something you've written about plenty with your thoughts, and particularly on John Maynard Keynes as an economist. At the moment, we have this sort of push and pull, this emotional tug of some people on one side wanting to worry about inflation, others really not so doing, and wanting to see the whites of the eyes of 2% if we ever get there. Do you think we'll ever get to an overshoot from your perspective? Do you think that it's something we should really legitimately be worrying about?
I think people who are supremely confident about what they think inflation is going to look like in the next 2 years or 2 months are... let's just say they have more confidence than I have. I think these price changes, they make sense until your model is wrong, right? I myself am not worried about this right now. I think the federal government can afford to spend, frankly, quite a few, but a few more trillion dollars before we have to worry about demand-driven inflation becoming a problem.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong. You know, that's like I've been wrong about stuff before. It happens sometimes. And if so, the thing that sort of animates me at this particular moment is that, you know, if we overshoot and we get too much and inflation does happen, there are an enormous number of tools in the Federal Reserve's toolkit right now that are just designed for fighting inflation. And they haven't been using them for like 15 years. So it doesn't seem to me to be that terrible a risk to overshoot. So we could overshoot, but if we do, I don't see what the catastrophe is.
But when we talk about those tools and I guess the potential negative effect of them having to sort of utilize those tools, should we start to see some sort of meaningful inflation, a lot of folks are saying, look, I mean, if you don't have some sort of a gradual normalization, then it means that you are sort of setting us up for what could be a policy shock or the need for a policy shock, similar to maybe what we saw in the late 70s, early 80s. Do you think that that's the potential risk here, or should we not be worried about that?
So the reason that I don't worry about that, and again, I could be wrong, but the reason that I don't worry about that is because in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, one of the reasons that Paul Volcker went for this extremely high interest rate policy was because you had not only high inflation, but also high unemployment. And so if you're only worried about one of those two variables, it seems like to me that there are pretty clear policy tools available to fight either one of them. When you have both of them at the same time and they're extremely elevated, then fighting one often seems like it can create problems for the other. It's not clear to me at all that if we have a little bit of extra inflation or even a lot of extra inflation, you know, more than we want in 2022, 2023, that we will also have elevated unemployment.
Right.
And so as a result of that, I think this problem is not super complicated. It's if you run the economy a little bit too hot or even a lot too hot, you know how to pull it back. And don't worry about it.
So let's talk more about hyperinflation. And you made the point at the beginning that it's a fundamentally different thing, that it's more about politics and losing faith. What does that mean? What is the sort of connection that we should think of? How it's different than running the economy hot, the connection between sort of losing faith in the system and true intense inflation that destroys people's savings and makes consumption impossible.
Yeah, I think to some extent, even talking about this is the sort of thing that freaks people out a little bit.
All right, well, thank you for coming on. Good luck with your book.
System. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know,
instead of freaking out about extreme inflation, we've been writing a lot about how just small inflation does hurt those that actually the Federal Reserve is trying to help the most at the moment, which are those on low income. The fact that food's getting more expensive, the fact that gasoline's getting more expensive. It does become a political and a philosophical issue, a bit, both of which you majored in.
Oh yes, certainly. And I didn't want to be dismissive to Joe there. I was trying to make a joke.
No.
I was insulting Joe. Yes, certainly. if consumer prices rise, the prices of the things that most people buy on a regular basis rise at a rapid level, that you know reduces the standard of living of ordinary people. That's bad. Ordinary people not being able to have access to a job and a paycheck is also a problem. So how you balance these two things together is always you know it's not necessarily obvious at any moment in time what the right call is there. But generally speaking, I tend to err on the side of more employment. And if you get too much employment and the inflation starts taking up, then okay, you know it's okay to take a minute and think about pulling back. But these political crises that Joe is talking about, things like the Weimar hyperinflation, I mean, this is what we're talking about. When that happens, that's a real breakdown in the collective faith of the right. society to believe in both the political legitimacy of the government and the value of the currency. That causes things to happen that don't square to, you know, the money supply or aggregate demand.
Exactly.
Things that are just out of control, and that's a different kind of problem.
And that's it for What You Missed This Week. If you like the show, make sure to subscribe and rate us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can catch our show every weekday from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Bloomberg TV and from 4 to 5 p.m. on Twitter. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.